Welcome to the Deep Dive, where we plunge into fascinating sources to extract the most important nuggets of knowledge for you. Today, we're taking a truly mind-bending deep dive into David Hume's A Treatise of Human Nature. This isn't just, you know, some dusty old philosophy book. It's a foundational text that completely upended how we understand ourselves, our knowledge, even our morality.
That's absolutely right. Hume's treatise was incredibly ambitious. A science of man, he called it. He was aiming to apply the same kind of rigorous method Newton used for physics, but to the human mind itself.
Wow. So like dissecting thoughts and feelings.
Pretty much. He wanted to uncover the actual drivers, you know, the unvarnished truth behind our thoughts, feelings, actions. And in doing that, he reveals some surprising and honestly kind of unsettling limits to our own reason. Our sources today, they pull from extensive scholarly analysis, accessible summaries, really trying to get the core of Hume's thinking for you.
Okay, let's unpack this then, because Hume's ideas, even from over 250 years ago, they still hit hard, right? They make us question what it really means to be human. So our mission today is to give you that shortcut, that kind of aha moment to understanding this philosophical masterpiece. All right, so who was this guy, the mind behind this philosophical earthquake? David Hume. Born 1711, Scottish Enlightenment figure.
Right.
What always gets me is his background. He was largely self-educated, actually dropped out of law school, told his family he had this insurmountable aversion to everything but the pursuits of philosophy and general learning. I love that.
Really committed.
And then he writes this massive work, The Treatise, when he's incredibly young, like 26 to 28.
It's amazing.
But it famously just tanked initially. Dud born from the press, they said. People just didn't get it. Or maybe didn't want to get it.
Well, it speaks to his unique genius, really. Hume wasn't just smart. He has this incredible knack for blending sharp logic with deep psychological insight. You see, unlike a lot of philosophers before him, he didn't start with abstract ideas about perfect reason. He started by looking. How do our minds actually work? What do we actually experience?
Grounded in reality.
Exactly. He famously wanted to be the Newton of the moral sciences. Looking for those basic observable principles governing our inner world, just like Newton found for the physical world.
So the Newton of the mind, if that was his goal, what is A Treatise of Human Nature actually about? What's the big project?
It's his attempt to apply that experimental method, that scientific thinking, to moral subjects, which for Hume meant, well, human nature itself, our understanding, our emotions, our ethics.
The whole package.
The whole package. The book takes you on this journey through three really fundamental areas. First, understanding how we know things. Second, the passions, our emotions, what drives us. And third, morals, how we judge right and wrong.
And I heard that's kind of destructive and constructive.
That's a great way to put it, yeah. He first meticulously dismantles a lot of traditional ideas about reason, certainty, knowledge, pulls the rug out. Then he tries to rebuild our understanding on a totally different foundation, observing how our minds actually function. So it's not just about the world outside, it's about how we come to believe anything about that world, ourselves, or what we should do, and the conclusions. Yeah, they can be pretty unsettling. They force you to rethink basic stuff.
Okay, here's where it really hits you, right? Hume basically forces you to think about the idea that many of your most fundamental beliefs, things you just assume are true, they aren't necessarily products of pure logical reason. They might actually be rooted in instinct, habit, feelings. It's like finding out the foundation of your house isn't concrete, it's jello.
Kind of, yeah. It shakes things up.
Okay, let's dig into those insights then, starting with book one of The Understanding. This is about how we form beliefs and, crucially, the limits of that. Hume kicks things off with this distinction. Seems simple at first, but it's key. Impressions versus ideas.
Right. Impressions are vivid, direct experiences.
Like the actual feeling of warmth from the sun or the taste of coffee right now.
Yeah.
Super vivid.
Exactly. And ideas, they're the faint copies. Like remembering the warmth later or thinking about the coffee's taste, much less intense.
Okay, makes sense. So what's the big deal?
The big deal is his copy principle. He argues that every genuine idea you have ultimately traces back to some original impression. If you have an idea, say, about God or the soul or perfect justice, and you can't point to the sensory experience, the impression it came from, Hume says it's basically meaningless noise.
Whoa. So that just wipes out a ton of traditional philosophy right there. Yeah. All those abstract concepts.
Pretty much. It sets really strict limits on what we can meaningfully think and talk about. It has to connect back to experience. But our minds aren't just, you know, a random jumble of these impressions and ideas. Hume talks about the association of ideas, how our thoughts link together.
Like mental connections.
Exactly. He spots three main ways. Resemblance, a picture makes you think of the person. Contiguity, thinking of one room, reminds you of the one next door. And the big one, cause and effect, seeing a wound makes you think of pain. It's like a kind of mental gravity organizing our thoughts.
Okay, cause and effect, you said that's the big one. This is where Hume really drops a philosophical bombshell, isn't it? Causation.
Right. Oh yeah, this is huge.
We all think one thing causes another. Flick a switch, light comes on, ball hits ball, second ball moves. Obvious, right?
Seems obvious. But Hume asks, what do you actually observe? When you see the first billiard ball hit the second, do you see some invisible force, some power making the second one move?
No, I just see one hit the other and then the second one moves every time.
Exactly. You only ever observe constant conjunction. Event A is consistently followed by event B, our super strong belief that A causes B. Hume argues it doesn't come from reason or direct observation of a causal power. It comes from a powerful psychological habit. We see it happen again and again, and our minds just get conditioned to expect B after A.
So it's like our brains are pattern matching machines, and we mistake the pattern for a real force.
That's a good way to think about it. That feeling of necessary connection, that oomph of causation. It isn't something out there in the world. It's an impression inside our own minds. It's the feeling of expectation we get after seeing things happen together constantly.
Wow. That really undermines, well, a lot of science, even everyday thinking, doesn't it? If we can't be sure about cause and effect.
It definitely challenges claims to absolute certainty about the external world based on causation. And it leads straight into his famous problem of induction. Why do we expect the future to be like the past? Why do we assume the sun will rise tomorrow just because it always has?
Because it always has. Seems logical.
But Hume says, where's the logic? There's no contradiction in imagining the sun not rising tomorrow. We expect it purely out of habit, this ingrained custom. It's a useful belief, essential for life, but it's not a logically proven certainty.
Okay, my head hurts a little. And then he hits us with the bundle theory of the self. This sounds even weirder.
Huh? It is pretty mind-bending.
He asks you to look inside your own mind, right? Try and find yourself, that core you that's always there through everything.
Yep. Try it now. Introspect. What do you find?
Thoughts, feelings, memory, sensations. It's all just changing, flashing by.
Exactly. Hume's point. He argued you never find a single fixed, continuous self in there. All you ever encounter is a bundle or collection of different perceptions, thoughts, feelings, images in constant rapid flux. There's no permanent, unchanging eye holding it all together. A movie, maybe, but without a screen or a projector. Just the flashing images.
I'm just a bundle. That's kind of disturbing.
It's a profoundly radical idea. And he connects this back to what he calls his skeptical solution.
Mm-hmm.
He's not saying stop believing in cause and effect or a continuous self. We can't help it. It's natural.
Mm-hmm.
But he's saying these core beliefs aren't ultimately justified by pure reason. They're products of custom, habit, instinct. These are the great guide of human life, not logic.
But what does that mean for things like personal identity? If I'm just a bundle, am I the same person I was yesterday? Or 10 years ago.
That's the million-dollar question it raises, isn't it? It suggests identity isn't some fixed essence, but more like a story we construct, a fluid process.
Yeah.
It's constantly being rebuilt.
Okay. So that's how we think, or how Hume says we think. What about what makes us act? Let's move to book two, Of the Passions. This is where he drops perhaps his most famous, most provocative line ever.
The big one. Yeah.
Reason is and ought only to be the slave of the passions and can never pretend to any other office than to serve and obey them.
Boom. Yeah.
Yeah.
That just completely reverses centuries of philosophy.
Because everyone thought reason was the king, the charioteer guiding the wild horses of emotion.
Right. Exactly. Plato, Aristotle, countless others. Reason was supposed to be in control. Hume just flips it completely. What he means is our ultimate goals, our desires, what we fundamentally want, those are our passions. They provide the driving force. Reason, it's just a really smart tool. It's the calculator, the map reader. It helps us figure out the best way to get what our passions already decided we want.
So I don't use reason to decide if I want that promotion. My desire for status or achievement, that's the passion driving it. Reason just helps me figure out the steps to get there.
Precisely. Reason can tell you how to achieve a goal or whether a goal is achievable or maybe point out the consequences. But it can't make you want something in the first place. The wanting comes from passion, from feeling.
He even gets into the nitty-gritty of specific emotions like pride and humility, love and hate.
Oh yeah, he does this incredibly detailed, almost mechanistic breakdown. He shows how these complex emotions arise from associating ideas about ourselves or others with pleasant or painful impressions. It's like early psychology. It's this very naturalistic view, looking at humans as part of the natural world, governed by psychological laws. And yeah, it challenges ideas about pure free will.
And you can see how this would influence later thinkers in psychology, cognitive science, looking at us as we are, not as we should be.
Absolutely. It pushed towards more empirical study of human motivation and decision making.
Okay, which leads us logically, or perhaps passionately, to book three of Morals. If reason is just a slave figuring out how, then where do our ideas of ought come from, our moral judgments?
Ah, yes. This brings us to another cornerstone of Hume, the famous is-ought problem.
The gap between facts and values.
Exactly. Hume noticed that writers would be talking about facts describing how the world is. And then, suddenly, without any logical justification, they'd switch to talking about how the world ought to be, making moral claims. Prescriptions. He argued you simply cannot logically leap from an is, a statement of fact, to an ought, a statement of moral value. There's a missing step that reason alone can't provide.
So if reason can't tell us what's right or wrong, where do morals come from?
Feelings. He argues moral distinctions arise from our moral sentiments. When we see an action or consider a character trait, it triggers a feeling in us, a feeling of approval or disapproval. That's the basis of morality. It's rooted in our emotional responses.
So murder is wrong isn't a rational truth like 2 + 2 = 4. It's more like murder makes us feel strong disapproval.
That's the core idea. The wrongness isn't a property of the act itself, discoverable by reason. It's a sentiment in the observer.
Okay, but if morality is just based on individual feelings, how do we have societies with shared laws and concepts like justice? He called justice an artificial virtue, didn't he?
He did. And artificial here doesn't mean fake. It means constructed, man-made. Things like justice, property rights, keeping promises, these aren't natural in the way gravity is. They are human conventions, systems we've developed over time because they're incredibly useful for social cooperation. They make society possible.
So we invented them because they work, for the good of the group.
Basically, yes, for mutual advantage. And the key psychological mechanism that makes this shared morality possible, that allows us to agree on these conventions, is sympathy, what we probably call empathy today. Our innate ability to feel with others, to resonate with their feelings of pleasure or pain. Sympathy allows our moral sentiments to extend beyond ourselves, creating a common ground for moral judgment and social rules.
Wow. Okay. Hume's treatise is just packed with these kinds of bombshells, these really powerful lines that stick with you. Let's maybe pull out a few key quotes or ideas and really nail down their meaning for you, the listener.
Good idea. Let's start with that absolute classic. Reason is and ought only to be the slave of the passions.
We touched on it, but what's the core takeaway for someone trying to understand themselves or others?
It's fundamentally shifting your view of motivation. Don't assume logic is the driver. Look for the underlying desires, the values, the feelings. Whether you're setting personal goals or trying to persuade someone, connect with the passion level. Reason is the servant, not the master.
Okay, how about this one? Custom, then, is the great guide of human life.
This really sums up his view on belief formation. Most of what we believe and do isn't from careful logical deduction. It's habit. It's the result of repeated experience conditioning our minds. Think about driving a car or trusting gravity or even your basic social interactions. It's mostly custom, habit, instinct, not explicit reasoning.
So recognize the power of habit in your own life and maybe be a bit more humble about how much reason is actually running the show day to day.
Exactly. And understand its power if you want to change behavior, yours or someone else's. Repetition builds the habit.
Okay, and that unsettling one about the self. The identity which we ascribe to the mind of man is only a fictitious one.
Fictitious, meaning constructed, not false in a simple sense. Your sense of a solid, continuous self. It's a mental narrative woven around that ever-changing bundle of perceptions. It's not a thing. It's more like a process, a story. This can actually be quite liberating. You're not stuck being one thing. Identity can evolve. It supports adaptability, learning, mindfulness.
Less fixed, more fluid. I like that. Okay, one more. Beauty is no quality in things themselves. It exists merely in the mind which contemplates them.
This extends that idea about morality. Value judgments, whether it's beauty in art or goodness in actions, aren't objective facts out there. They are projections of our internal sentiments, our feelings. What one person finds beautiful, another might not. What one culture values, another might not. It encourages a kind of perspective taking, realizing our truths about value are often rooted in our subjective experience.
So after all this deep philosophical stuff, how can Hume's ideas from way back then actually help you in your daily life? What are the practical applications?
Well, there are quite a few, actually. First, improve critical thinking, especially about cause and effect. Don't just assume because B followed A that A caused B. Look for constant conjunction, sure, but be skeptical of simple causal stories. Think correlation versus causation. Super useful for analyzing news, business data, even personal experiences.
Right. Don't jump to conclusions about why something happened.
Exactly. Second, understanding emotional decision making. Remember, reason is the slave. Recognize that you and everyone else are driven by passions, values, emotions. If you want to motivate yourself or manage others or persuade anyone, appeal to those underlying feelings, not just dry logic. Work with human nature, not against it.
Makes sense for leadership, marketing, even just personal relationship.
Absolutely. Third, that fluid sense of self we talked about, the bundle theory. If you internalize that identity isn't fixed, it can be really freeing. It makes it easier to adapt, to learn from mistakes without feeling like you are fundamentally flawed. Supports personal growth and resilience. You can change.
Like, okay, that was a bundle of thoughts and actions I didn't like. Let's cultivate a different bundle.
Kind of. And fourth, habit formation. Since custom is the great guide, understanding this helps deliberately build better habits. Focus on repetition, creating the right associations, making the desired behavior the easy habitual path, more effective than just trying to reason yourself into it.
So harness the power of habit consciously.
Yes. And finally, maybe social and political understanding. Recognizing that institutions, laws, moral codes are human conventions built for utility and cooperation, not handed down from on high, can lead to more pragmatic approaches. It encourages focusing on what works for human flourishing and being open to reforming conventions when they stop serving their purpose.
So what does this all mean for us, the learners of today? What's the big takeaway from Hume?
I think the most valuable lesson is this fundamental shift in perspective. We aren't primarily these coolly rational creatures who occasionally get bothered by feelings. We are, at our core, emotional and social beings who have this amazing tool called reason. Hume teaches a healthy skepticism, be wary of claims to absolute certainty, but also to trust the practical reliability of the beliefs that custom and experience give us. We need them to live.
So he doesn't give easy answers like, here's the meaning of life. But he transforms how we ask the questions about knowledge, about ourselves, about society.
Precisely. He forces us to be more honest about the foundations of our own beliefs and motivations.
And maybe this leaves you with a final thought to chew on. If you really take on board that reason is the slave of the passions, how might that actually change the way you approach setting your own life goals, or even just how you try to connect with the people around you every day?
That's a great question to reflect on.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into David Hume. We really encourage you to keep exploring these incredibly relevant and fascinating ideas on your own.